Hello, I'm Andrew Lord. This is number 0201, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0201. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, another visit from Rod Pyle, the author of Destination Mars. He's back on the show to talk about man's quest to go to the red planet.
The more we learn about it, the harder and harder it is to get there and stay there. So the answer, I think, is it's still the target. It's the holy grail for NASA for a couple of reasons. One, it's just been on their radar for a really long time. And two, if you're going to get the public engaged, you really have to do something beyond Earth orbit. The space station's cool, but really, people want NASA to have an adventure. And Mars just has uber sex appeal when it comes to going to another planet. So I think ultimately, yes, the question is when? And with whose money?
Literary expert Len Lammensdorf on the pros and cons of ebooks versus paper books. One advantage would be all textbooks to be in digital form.
One of the great advantages of this is for students. And so far they haven't been able to take advantage of it because the schools, the universities, the authors, the professors are insisting they buy a new book each year, which is absurd. They spend hundreds of dollars a semester. And now, next semester, there's a new edition. Well, they ought to change it online. But instead, they force these kids to buy a new edition. It's not really fair.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. How can people avoid getting arrested for buying counterfeit merchandise on Canal Street? Well, loyal Stuff File listeners have a way out.
I got a special offer for your people, the people who listen to your broadcast. Here's the deal. You're going to issue all your listeners a card identifying them as a loyal Peter Anthony Holder listener. And of course, you'll sign it. And they'll carry it with them when they come to New York. If they get arrested for buying a counterfeit, I and a group of thug cab drivers will break them out of jail. But that's because they have your official ID card on them.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0201, was Andrew Lord, creative lead at the advertising firm Bleu Blanc Rouge. He was also one of my old producers on the old radio show I did oh so many years ago back in the day. Thank you very much, Andrew, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And by the way, just between you and me, Andrew was one of the better producers on the program back in the day as well. Anyway, on to the stuff, shall we? Well, we always see the signs, please don't feed the animals, and we figure it's common sense, unless you're at a city park throwing breadcrumbs to ducks or at a petting zoo, you don't want wild animals interested in you. But apparently, if you are in Alaska and drunk, this obvious advice doesn't apply. At least the man in this story didn't think it applied to him. He was wrong. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says a black bear mauled a man at a campground north of Anchorage. A spokesman said the bear was pretty much goaded into the attack because the man fed it meat from a church barbecue. Alaska State Troopers spokeswoman Beth Ipson said the man had been drinking and went for a bike ride, taking some of the food along. He came across the bear and threw it a piece of meat. When he offered the bear another piece, it attacked. I'm guessing he wanted a bigger piece, if you know what I mean. The man was treated for puncture wounds and scratches at an Anchorage hospital. As an added bonus, he may be charged with illegally feeding wildlife. Ooh, burn. This is the kind of story we like to call the Darwin starter kit, because someone this stupid will eventually find a way to remove themselves from the planet. It's just a matter of time. And then it becomes a Darwin file story, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Now, several students at Chase Lake Elementary School in Edmonds, Washington, have been suspended for playing with toy Nerf guns at school. You see where this is going, don't you? This is another zero-tolerance story, which I tend to rail against and loathe, but here we go. Now, why would fourth and sixth graders be that stupid in a zero-tolerance school environment? Because their teacher approved it, planning a lesson in statistics by shooting the guns 100 times to see how the shots vary. If the teacher and the school staff don't even know their own rules, how are the children supposed to know them? Asked one parent of a suspended student. Gee, that's a pretty decent question if you ask me. A district spokeswoman said the punishment is at the discretion of the principal and it's a matter of safety and it's of the utmost importance. The parents are appealing the punishment, which, in addition to one-day suspensions, include a ban on serving on the student council and a ban on high-level algebra classes. What? Wait a minute. So, because the teacher said that they should do this as an experiment, these students can't take high school level algebra classes. What is this, in a vain attempt to keep them stupid? Wow. It's one thing, and again, I don't agree with the zero tolerance thing, but if you're going to apply this cockamamie law, well, fine. But it's one thing to punish a child with some sort of detention or suspension. It's another thing to prevent them from taking a class that would enhance their education. I don't get it. But anyway, while we're talking about idiotic school ideas and zero tolerance, let's do one more story, okay, on this similar vein. Officials at Old Mill Pond Elementary School in Palmer, Massachusetts, have changed their mind and dropped charges against a 6-year-old boy who brought a gun onto the school bus. The principal said he caused quite a disturbance on the bus and that the children were traumatized, said the boy's mother, Mikey Crane. Except, it wasn't a gun, but rather a 2-inch plastic toy rifle that came with a G.I. Joe doll. And Crane said a review of security video from the bus showed the children were not standing up hollering, nobody was ducking, no one was screaming, he's got a gun. The unnamed boy was made to write a letter of apology, even though school officials admitted that there was never a real gun on the bus and no one was ever in danger. And let's back up a second. You're making a 6-year-old write a letter of apology. Mm-hmm. Crane's own mother, a retired school principal herself, agrees school officials overreacted. By the way, they said no one was in danger, as I mentioned, and Crane, the mother, said, I don't think he understood the zero tolerance policy. Again, I repeat, he's 6. Okay. As I said, Crane's own mother is a retired principal herself. She agrees school officials overreacted. She says, I would have said, put it away or take it home or I'll hold on to it until the end of the day. The problem is we don't use our heads. That's what Sarah Godek said, who, again, is Crane's mother, who herself is a retired school principal. Well, you know, Sarah, I have to disagree with you slightly. No. The problem is that most school officials who knew how to use their heads, like yourself, have retired. That's the problem, in a nutshell. Anyway, time for one more story here on the Stuff File News segment here before we get to our first guest on the program. Carol Longhorn, age 65, was gardening outside her Melton Constable, Norfolk, England home when her spade hit something metal, an unexploded World War II bomb. She immediately put a plastic chair on top of the bomb in case it went off, because that would save it, wouldn't it? Yeah. And then set about deciding what to do. I called my husband to come and have a look at it, she said, but he wouldn't, so I brought it indoors. She set it on the coffee table, but then, according to her husband, Clive, who is 60, I heard a rattle in the kitchen and saw her washing it in the blooming sink. You can imagine what I said to her. The Longhorns called the police, and a bomb disposal team took the device to a nearby quarry and set it off in a controlled detonation. The bomb disposal team said it was live and that we were very lucky, Clive said. The bloke said to me, tell the wife if she finds any more to put them in a neat little pile and we'll deal with them all at once. Really? A neat little pile? Yeah. Okay, why are the police asking her to put them in a heap? And also, what kind of neat freak is Carol? I mean, who cleans a bomb in a sink? I don't know, maybe she heard about dirty bombs and was really afraid. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff Out program, shall we? A few weeks ago, we talked to NASA expert Rod Pyle about the 40th anniversary of Skylab. At the time, we also mentioned that he's the author of several books, including his latest one, Destination Mars. I thought we should have him back on the show to talk about Mars, so once again, on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from Pasadena, California, here is Rod Pyle. Welcome back, Rod.
Thank you very much.
So we are now embarking, or at least talking more about going to Mars, not just perhaps with rovers that are up there now, but actually sending people. Is that where we're headed? And is it in the near future or distant future, as far as you're concerned?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I like to say, since I'm in my mid-50s, and since I was a kid when I first read Wernher von Braun's book about going to Mars, you know, he said back then, and I think it was 1948 when he actually published the thing, we'll be to Mars within 30 years. And the last time I checked with NASA, we'll be to Mars within 30 years. I mean, it seems to be this target that keeps moving away at the same rate. Interestingly, you know, what we're finding out about Mars is that it gets, the more we learn about it, the harder and harder it is to get there and stay there. So the answer, I think, is it's still the target. It's the holy grail for NASA for a couple of reasons. But one, it's just been on their radar for a really long time. And two, if you're going to get the public engaged, you really have to do something beyond Earth orbit. The space station's cool. You know, people have this vague idea that it's up there, and they're about to start doing some really amazing stuff with stem cells growing organs in orbit and all this. But really, people want NASA to have an adventure. You know, we've been to orbit, other countries are going to orbit. We need to go out there somewhere, which means either the moon, an asteroid, or Mars, and Mars just has uber sex appeal when it comes to going to another planet. So I think ultimately, yes, the question is when and with whose money.
Is part of the lure of going to Mars looking literally into potentially the Earth's future?
Maybe. It certainly is looking into the Earth's past. You know, the more digging they do with the Curiosity rover and the recent results that came down from Opportunity, more and more we're seeing a familiar story if you look way back at Earth's history. And then there was some news out of University of Hawaii about a week ago from a meteorite, Martian meteorite, that did some work on. We find these meteorites occasionally, usually up in the Antarctic, that are clearly pieces of Mars that got blown off way back when and fell to Earth. And they're finding that somewhere around 4 billion years ago, Mars had a very oxygen-rich atmosphere. And in fact, it had that about 2 billion years before Earth did. So at one point, Mars appears to be a more temperate, wet, oxygen-rich planet, which again really argues for this idea that there's probably, if not life there, there was at one point, and we may very well have some shared ancestry there. But in terms of what Earth will become, you know, it's hard to say. Mars had a lot of water at one point in liquid form, apparently. Now it's locked up in ice. But the dynamics are so different. I mean, we're much closer to the sun. We get a lot more solar energy. There's a different chemical composition here. It looks like a lot more ice hit our planet and stayed here over, you know, the millennia. So hard to say exactly what the future will hold, but it certainly is informative.
From our perspective, what is the fascination of going to Mars as opposed to going to the other direction? Not that I want to get closer to the sun personally, but Venus.
Well, Venus is a nasty place. You know, Mars is tough to get to. And it's got a very thin atmosphere, somewhat low gravity, and kind of a slightly toxic environment. There's a lot of radiation. There's perchlorate in the soil, which is toxic to people, and high enough concentrations and all that. But you can stand on the surface and walk around and do things in a pressure suit. Venus has an atmospheric pressure of almost 1,000 pounds per square inch as opposed to 14.5 sea level on Earth. And it's got a temperature of about 900 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's got acidic rain. The atmosphere is really highly toxic and pressurized and scalding hot. So there's really, unfortunately, not much to be done at Venus on the surface. There's been some talk about being able to do some research if you could somehow position a station in the upper atmosphere where it's more temperate. But, you know, when you can't go down to the surface of a planet, it's a lousy place to stay. So Venus and Mercury are probably off the list. We've got to go the other direction.
Now, your book, which is Destination Mars, it basically takes a look at the complete story of humanity's missions to the red planet. Who are you trying to reach with your book? And what's the biggest point you want to get across to the reader?
Well, the best comment I've gotten so far was from a publisher, not the publisher of that book, but another publisher who read it because they were interested in something else I was doing and said, you know, this reads like an adventure novel. And that's really what I was hoping for. It can be tough to take that kind of science and make it palatable to the public, and even tougher to make it palatable and hopefully exciting and engaging. So that's really what I've tried to do with all my books. I say I write popular science books, but they're not really science books. They're little science romances, you know. So my hope is to be able to bring people the kind of passion that I've felt for space exploration ever since the Apollo days. And that's really been my mission so far in these things.
Are you happy with where NASA is right now with the latest advances in using, in this case, robotics? We haven't sent man to Mars yet, but using rovers to the extent that we've been using them and things that we've been finding. Are you happy, or do you think we're still behind where we should be? I know you said that 30-year period keeps moving every year, but how do you feel about what's currently happening on Mars?
Well, you know, you can always step up the pace of these programs. I mean, the United States landed two big, heavy landers there in 1976, and they did a lot of good science within the limits of that time. We could have been following with rovers much sooner than 96. There's a 20-year lag there. And we could have gotten some of that Curiosity up there sooner, and we could be sending more up there more quickly. The question is, what drives that? And what drives that, unfortunately, for the program, is pure science and, to coin a phrase, curiosity. When you don't have a financial imperative, you know, we haven't discovered diamonds 18 feet across on the surface of Mars waiting to be picked up, and there aren't Amazonian women running around flirting with future astronauts, so it's hard to make an argument that we have to go there. The argument is we want to go there. When you're talking about Earth orbit, and the moon and the asteroids, there are financial incentives because they're beginning to realize there's all these materials out there that have happened from comet impacts and so forth. There's ice, there's metals, there's all this stuff you can actually use to build other things in orbit. Mars is a tougher argument. Yeah, I wish we were further ahead than we are, but you know, if we had sent people, there was a lot of talk towards the end of Apollo of let's repurpose this equipment and start thinking about sending people to Mars in the early 80s. We didn't know then how hostile the environment is, not just on Mars, but getting there. The solar radiation is a huge problem. The cosmic radiation coming from outside the solar system is a huge problem. It's very hard on people. It's destructive to DNA. So we've got to be able to get enough mass up there to create some shielding. And I think we're just at the point now where we probably are soon going to have, especially with this new big rocket that NASA's building, be tested in 2017, we'll have enough throw weight that we can get up there, start mining some of these asteroids and other bodies, get enough mass that we don't have to send up into orbit, it's already out there, that we can build one of these shielded spacecraft and finally get out to Mars. So as much as I'd like to see us ahead of where we are, we're probably at about the right spot. The question really is, what are we going to do now?
How do you feel about some of the commercial ideas that people are putting out there? One of them is as far-fetched as sending a couple out there just to go there and back. See if we can do it. How do you feel about those kinds of projects and others besides NASA making the attempt to go at least close to Mars as opposed to even landing on it?
Well, there's two widely circulated ideas going around now by two companies. There's Inspiration Mars, which is one you're talking about, which is Dennis Tito, one of the early space tourists. He's putting $100 million of his own money into this plan to put two people in a spacecraft in 2018, send him out for a loop around Mars and come back. The reason he calls it Inspiration Mars is it's really not a science mission, although there will be some good science out there. It's really an adventure, a lark. It's to be inspiring to get people excited about space travel again, and these people are going to... It's like going to the Antarctic in 1905. You know, you're really out there on your own with no help, hope of rescue. The other one is Mars One. This comes out of Holland. A guy named Bas Lansdorp. It's a little more far-fetched. You know, he wants to start sending rovers up in 2016. He wants to start landing unmanned spacecraft there in 2018, 2020. And then 2022 or 23, he wants to send up the first three or four people on a one-way trip to be colonists. It's asking a lot. Now, if they get that hardware up there to start processing atmosphere and growing food and all that kind of stuff early enough, it could work. I think the question is, should it be done, and who's going to pay for it? Again, you've got this money problem. He's been saying that he wants to finance it with reality TV revenue. I worked in reality TV for a long time, and I never saw that kind of money anywhere, so I'd be surprised if that one worked. But I think the first one, Inspiration Mars, is doable, and I hope he does it. There's a major announcement coming out soon from those guys. I don't know what it is, but it'll be out soon.
Are you surprised that the only competition NASA has, and by extension the United States has, are private entities as opposed to other governments or other countries?
Well, that's an interesting conversation. I mean, the Chinese are aggressively moving into orbit. They've had a program that's kind of followed in the footsteps of what we did in the 60s. They're working with repurposed Soviet-era hardware. But they've been to orbit, I think, four times now. They have a small space station they're putting together. So they're not racing us to Mars, but they're certainly intending to go back to the moon. And, you know, they don't have to have congressional debates and votes and changes of administration every 4 years. They can decide to go, chat about it for a while, and then a big program gets rolling, and they can afford it. So there is some competition other than the private sector, but you're right, not for Mars at this point. I think it is kind of surprising. You know, the Russians had talked about it for many, many decades from about the same time we started discussing it. But I just don't think the economics are there for them, and their hardware has really sort of stagnated since the 70s. They haven't put the money into it that we have.
Okay, so last question. You've written the book Destination Mars. Would you like to go yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? At my age, you know, I'm 56. At my age, if I get a little bit of damage to my DNA, that's okay. If I could get out there and live for another 15 or 20 years, I'd do it in a heartbeat. So if you know somebody, let me know, okay?
Okay. The book is called Destination Mars. People can also check out your website. And there are several to look at. There's rodpilebooks.com. There's rodpilemedia.com. And there's also a blog as well, correct?
Yeah. It's...
Destination Mars, Marsbook.blogspot.com.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
There you go. Rod, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure. Look forward to seeing you again.
Rod Pyle, author of Destination Mars. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0201, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about e-books versus paper books. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, will share a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But right now we have more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, you know, things are different in China. Here's just one example. Chengdu, China barber Liu Dehuan, age 53, is one of the few people who still provide traditional eye shaving. Yeah, you heard me right. Eye shaving, in which he holds the eye open and runs a razor across the lid's inner surfaces. Yeesh. Then, using a thin metal rod with a round tip, he gently massages the inside of each eyelid. Liu told a reporter for the Chengdu Business Daily in April that he had never had an accident, though the reporter apparently could not be enticed to experience the treatment himself, preferring merely to observe. And a highly satisfied customer reported afterward that his eyes felt moist and his vision clearer. Yes. A local hospital official said eye shaving can scrape away scar tissue and stimulate the eyes to lubricate the eye sockets. Okay, how many of you actually cringed when I read that story? I mean, talk about an eye-opener. Literally. Anyway, a marriage-encouraging initiative in the Sihor district of India's Madhya Pradesh state awards gifts and financial assistance to couples agreeing to wed in mass ceremonies, but the country also suffers from a notorious toilet shortage. The district announced in May that to qualify for the government benefits, the groom must submit to officials a photo of himself beside his own toilet to prove that he and his wife will have home sanitation. Now, clearly, these will be marriages that are flush with success. Okay, we have two stories dealing with people who are apparently closer to God than you and I could ever be. Number one, Crystal McVie, author of a recent book chronicling her near-death experience, told a Fox and Friends TV host in April, and now that I've said Fox and Friends, your opinion of this woman's credibility has just dropped, hasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, she told a Fox and Friends TV host in April that among her most vivid memories of the incident was getting so close to God that she could smell him. Oh, please, don't tell me he smells like aqua velva or musk. Please. And number two, in May, Anna Pierre, a candidate for mayor of North Miami, Florida, announced on her Facebook page that she had secured the endorsement of Jesus Christ. That would be doubly fortunate for her since a month earlier, she had complained that unknown people had been leaving bad luck, voodoo ritual feathers, food scraps, and candles at her doorstep. Jesus' endorsement, by the way, is apparently not what it used to be. She finished 7th in the race. Well, you know what they say, the Lord does work in mysterious ways. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, drug dealing is a dirty business, but what's up with all the Tide? It seems dopers are trading the detergent for crack and pot. San Bernardino, California Police Sergeant Travis Walker says detectives raiding dope houses were stumped when they found lots of Tide. He tells the Riverside Press Enterprise the drug buyers are swapping the expensive laundry detergent for a fix, Walker says one local supermarket chain reports losing hundreds of dollars worth of Tide each week. Well, you know, just because you're on drugs doesn't mean you don't want to be clean or springtime fresh. I'm just saying. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Books have entered the digital world with the introduction of e-books. It has completely transformed the way people read and publish books. Is that a good thing? Well, joining us on the line right now is Len Lammensdorf, who is a literary expert, acclaimed playwright, and the author of the award-winning book, The Ballad of Billy Lee, the story of George Washington's favorite slave. Len's on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Len.
Hi there.
Thanks.
Glad to be on the line, and I can tell you right away, e-books are wonderful, and it's a fantastic step forward for anybody who wants to write.
Well, tell me from both perspectives, both either the reader and the writer, what are the pros and cons? Because nothing's perfect, so there's got to be something that it doesn't help. But what are the pros and cons to e-books versus paper?
Well, all right. Of course, you don't have some lovely book that you can put on a shelf in your home. Instead, you have this e-book on your phone or your iPad or your computer, your Kindle, if you have that connection. And the thing is, for example, I use Kindle, and I have maybe a dozen books on it. If I were to have 12 real books, physical books, that would weigh several pounds, and it would be a very large package. But I'm able to carry this around with me, and I'm able to go back and forth on it as I choose. One of the many advantages you get with an e-book is you can change the size of the font. You know, I tend to read when I'm going to sleep at night, and I need a little bigger type then. And for people who have an eye problem, it's good too. But for everybody, you can adjust the type to the size that you want, and you can hold so many books on just the one piece of equipment. And these things are not expensive anymore. You can buy a Kindle for under $200, under $100. Pretty soon you'll be able to buy them for $25 or $50 or something like that, and you'll have that complete mobility. Now, I admit that I'm a guy who likes to flip up and back in a book and put a piece of paper on a page or just hold it with a finger and then go to somewhere else in the book. You can flip up and back in an e-book, but you can't hold it. You can mark it, you can flag it, but you can't hold on to it. For some people, that's really important. And for me, it just isn't that important. And I'm glad that I can publish my books as I have. The book you were talking about, The Ballad of Billy Lee, The Story of George Washington's Favorite Slave, is on Amazon. You can buy it as an e-book. You can buy it as a physical book. You can go to my website, lenlammensdorf.com. And you can buy it there, either as an e-book or as a physical book. So the amount of flexibility is just tremendous.
Well, are you finding, especially, let's talk about your books. You've written several books. Are you finding that there are more people buying the e-books, or as I like to refer to as the dead tree books?
Well, the fact of the matter is that I'm selling more e-books than dead tree books. And it's not surprising. The book is 19.95, except where it might be on sale somewhere. And the e-book is $9.95. So it is roughly half the price. And there are many books. I don't like to knock my own product, but there are many e-books that you can buy for $3.99 or $2.99 or something like that. And one of the great advantages of this is for students. And so far they haven't been able to take advantage of it because the schools, the universities, the authors, the professors are insisting they buy a new book each year. which is absurd. I've got family in university at the present time. They spend hundreds of dollars a semester for books. And now, next semester, there's a new edition. Well, they ought to change it online. They ought to change it by making these easy corrections on an e-book. But instead, they force these kids, and adults as well, to buy a new edition. It's not really fair.
Okay, so you mentioned a lot of the pros to using e-books versus paper books. Do you admit that there are any, besides the fact that some people just like to flip pages, besides that, are there any cons to e-books as opposed to paper?
Well, you know, I personally have a library that's probably thousands of books that are physical books, what you call dead tree books. And I love to go through them. And I've since a childhood, I've loved the feel of a book. Well, you don't get that with a Kindle or a Nook or any of these other variations. You miss that. And I do too. And it also, books are pretty. You know, when I look at the shelves in my home, in my library section, I like the look of the books, and I like the fact that I can take one out, and I can take two of them out and flip them, hold them side by side, and compare something. You know, a lot of what I do has a historical basis, and it's easier for me to check it by holding the books or holding a physical book and an e-book. But look, nothing is perfect. These books are going to get better. E-books are going to get better and better. And physical books, I don't see that there's going to be an improvement. By the way, one of the things is you go through the Ballad of Billy Lee. When you get to the end of the book, there are a number of links, and you can press on those links, check on those links, and you can find other material that's very interesting. You can find speeches by various historians about the subject matter of my book. You can find other books very easily and click onto them. So the flexibility is tremendous. I'm not going to give up on, let's call them, real books instead of virtual books. I'm not going to give up on that. I want to have those books. But I'm delighted to have this other alternative, which enables me, as an author, I can avoid publishers, I can avoid editors, I can avoid stores. I can stay out of the marketplace and create my own marketplace. What an incredible step forward.
Okay, so do you think that there will be a time where paper books will disappear into the digital age?
I hope not. I hope not. But I'm afraid that will happen, because the cost is just a fraction. And as the years go by, these books will become much easier to produce. They will cost less. One of the other advantages in the paperback edition of my book, there are some 30, 35 illustrations. They're in black and white, because I couldn't afford to have them in color. In the e-book, they're in color, because it doesn't add to the cost in any significant way. So I seem to be selling e-books. I'm sure Amazon will be happy with me, but at the same time, I'm happy with them. They have created a marketplace that is simply enormous, and that all of us can participate in. I'm sorry that bookstores are going out of business, particularly the smaller local stores. I regret that. But on the other hand, those people can provide a service you can't find in an e-book. If you go into one of the better local bookstores, the people that own that and run that, they will have an enormous amount of knowledge, and they will be able to guide you in finding what you're looking for.
Well, we just got about a minute, and I'll just mention this. I am also somebody who uses my e-reader all the time. I have a Kindle. But in the world of music, there is a renaissance. There are those who are rediscovering, and they're not people who are old enough to remember the when it was an everyday occurrence. There are those who are rediscovering vinyl. And I wouldn't be surprised if, for that very reason, books will always have a place, even with the younger generation, because, as you say, there is something to be said about flipping through a book as opposed to just looking at it online or on an e-reader.
Well, let me tell you something. When you spoke about vinyl, the finest digital recording is not as good as the best analog recording, the vinyl. And if you talk to famous pianists, orchestra directors, conductors, they will tell you that there is a quality and an essence in the sound on the vinyl that you cannot find on the digital.
Len, I thank you very, very much for talking to us about ebooks versus paper books. We should mention once again, your book is called The Ballad of Billy Lee, The Story of George Washington's Favorite Slave. And I thank you for being on the program with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Len Lammensdorth, author of The Ballad of Billy Lee, The Story of George Washington's Favorite Slave. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0201, and you'll find links to Len's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book for the Kindle directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Are unpaid internships now illegal in the United States? That's the question many are asking after a federal judge ruled in favor of two students who sued a movie studio that had given them unpaid internships. The judge says the interns should have been paid, even though they volunteered and received valuable experience and contacts that could help them get a job after graduating. Thousands of college students are now wondering if they'll lose their summer internship because their employer can't afford to pay them. Let's be fair, that's a good question, but for now, there are more questions than answers. There is, however, one type of unpaid internship that appears to be safe. Students looking for experience in Congress can still get unpaid internships. Why? Because Congress exempted itself from the federal labor laws that the two students used to file their lawsuit. And if you're wondering why that's fair, you're not the only one. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Yes, we go to New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Broadway's up and the battery's down. And Peter Franklin is with us once again, the Gabby Cabby. Hello, sir.
Hello, live from the streets of New York.
Yes, now, anyone who goes to New York City, they're all aware of the fact that you can get wonderful things that are not quite the real thing on Canal Street. And one of the things, I guess, is counterfeit bags. But yeah. I understand they're clamping down on this.
Well, I don't know. It's another one of these silly kind of things that shows you that politicians and government officials have nothing better to do with their free time, if they have any, than to start dreaming up cockamamie laws. As it stands now, you can go to places like Canal Street and buy a duplicate, or really not a duplicate, a counterfeit, a Louis Vuitton or Prada or Oakley sunglasses. Or, you know, one of these kinds of things. And people do it, and they think they're getting a great deal. And I don't know. I guess the whole thing is silly. The companies aren't really losing that much money on it because, let's face it, if you were going to go and buy a $40,000 watch at Tiffany's, a Rolex, you wouldn't not buy it and go to Canal Street and get one for $6. So I'm not so sure who gets hurt. The city gets hurt, because the city doesn't collect any sales tax from these people. So, for whatever reason, they've introduced a law now which will make it illegal for someone to buy the item. Now, that's absolutely insane for a couple of reasons. First of all, it can't be enforced in any way, because all that the perp has to do is say, gee, I don't know. I thought I was just getting a good buy, and I thought it was a real Rolex. How did I know it was a calendar kind of fake one? So that's number one. Number two, even if you did arrest these people, where are we going to put them all? I mean, on any given day, there's probably 8 gazillion people that are buying stuff on Canal Street alone. So the fact of the matter, you know, remains is very silly. But listen, I got a special offer for your people, the people who listen to your broadcast. Here's the deal. You're going to issue all your listeners a card identifying them as a loyal Peter Anthony Holder listener. And, of course, you'll sign it. And they'll carry it with them when they come to New York. If they get arrested for buying a counterfeit, I and a group of thug cab drivers will break them out of jail. But that's because they have your official ID card on them.
I like it. I like it a lot. Now, it's interesting because and I haven't been to New York in a long, long time, and certainly haven't been down to Canal Street, but I'm fully aware of it. When people are buying things on Canal Street, they're literally buying them on the street?
Yeah. I mean, they you know, look, there's some showmanship, sort of like, come on in the back of the store and I'll give you a real part. It's baloney. I mean, it's open and nobody cares anything about it. And the play acting is purely for Hicks from Iowa.
So if this is something that the city wanted to clamp down on, rather than going after the clients, as it were, couldn't they just raid the place, or the other side of the coin, do nothing but have heavy police presence in the area just to scare people off? Wouldn't both of those things work?
It's not even that complicated. What they do is they go over the U-Haul and rent a truck. Then they drive along Canal Street, picking up all of the counterfeit merchandise and putting it in the back of the U-Haul truck. Then they take it to a big field and set fire to it. You do that 2 or 3 times, that's the end of the situation. I mean, I'm not particularly advocating that, but I'm just saying it's much ado about anything. Now, I know the way the U.S. government works is that now they will start using drones to cover Canal Street. And in addition to that, they're probably making plans to wiretap and collect data from the Internet and emails on Canal Street, because that's the way my government operates. And my way of just renting a truck, I think, is a lot easier.
Certainly a lot cheaper. Okay, on to other things. What's this story about erecting a fence to keep out turtles?
Yeah, well, Kennedy Airport, the big international airport, is right next to the ocean, and it's also right next to something called Gateway National Park, which is kind of a refuge for all kinds of flora and fauna. Well, the turtles, every once in a while, decide to go for a little stroll, and there can be hundreds and even thousands of them who start walking across the runways at Kennedy. Well, as the 747 comes in, you hear the sound of crunch, crunch, crunch. Now, it's not really a danger to the planes. It's not like the Canadian birds that make our planes crash. So, you know, it's really being done, I guess, I don't know, to keep the runways clean. I mean, it's certainly not a safety factor,
okay,
except for the turtles.
Okay.
So they're putting up a 4,000-foot fence, and then they will get a drone to patrol it, and, of course, they will wiretap and check emails of all people at the airport, because, again, that's the way my government works.
Okay. Now, I've heard of bookworms, but I've never heard of bedbugs at a library.
And you're right, because it's all a scam. You know, for a while, people were checking at the hotels in New York, and then they'd go downstairs to the desk indignantly, and they'd show some bedbugs that they had found in their beds. Well, then it turned out they had actually brought the bed bugs to the hotel in a little box. Very clever. And that's what they were using to try to get some money out of the hotel. Well, now it's been tried at the libraries a few times, where people bring back a book and they claim that these are the bed bugs they found in the book, and it messed up their homes because of it, and the city should pay damages. Again, I always have a simple solution to all such problems. If the bed bugs are not wearing glasses, then you know they didn't come out of the book.
Good point. Good point. Now, I also understand that there are some people in New York City who are getting paid even though they're dead. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there's been no checking. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things. I mean, this happens many places. In New York, it's especially become a big problem because we have so many people. And I think what people figure is, oh, grandma is dead, but why should I tell anybody? I'll continue to get her various benefit checks until they catch up with me. And what do you know? They never catch up with me, so you just keep the money. So there has to be some kind of cross-section. Because working at the present way, where you're supposed to voluntarily give the information. See, all of us think that when we die, we, me, you, the whole world is going to know about it. Well, maybe six relatives will know about it, but nobody else will know about it.
Mm. And speaking of dead people, I've always heard the stories of rent control going on in New York City and people willing apartments to their loved ones. Is that still going on? Is there still that rent control situation where there are actually cheap apartments in New York City that are well undervalued?
Well, I wouldn't say cheap. They're inexpensive or less expensive.
Yes.
But just wait a minute before everybody starts feeling sorry for the landlords. Under rent stabilization, apartments that were built, in the World War II era. This doesn't apply to new buildings, older buildings. The landlord is locked into a certain profit, a return on his money, of maybe about 5 or 6%, which is not too bad, considering what you get from a lot of things. So if it's a brand-new building, they can charge anything they want, but if it's an older building, they have these guidelines. And the reason for that is there's a lot more tenant voters in the city than there are landlord voters. It's not a bad system. As it is, the landlords just exploit the system so unbelievable in New York City that you have to have some control on at least a portion of the people who live here.
Gotcha. And before I let you go, there's always a celebrity sighting with you. I understand that you actually saw Rob Lowe?
Yeah, well, there's a very big famous hospital here called Sloan Kettering, and they do wonderful things for people who have cancer. And I happen to be over there. I don't have cancer. I happen to be over there, and he was there visiting patients. And I thought, oh, well, he's probably here visiting, you know, one of his relatives. But no, it turned out, I found out from one of the staff members that he wasn't here visiting any of his relatives. He was just visiting people who have cancer, and he was being a nice guy. So when I hear something like that or see something like that, I want everybody to know who's the good guys and who's the bad guys, and certainly Rob Lowe is a good guy in my mind.
Mm. And one of the good guys in my mind is certainly Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. People can check out your website by going to www.gabby.com. And they could also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. And I urge folks, if they're ever in New York City, to get in contact with you, because I understand you also give wonderful tours as well.
Well, thank you so much for saying that.
And thank you once again for being on the program, sir.
Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We have time for just one more item on the program, and you know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Hooking for bail money. Now, a Montana man has been sentenced to 2 years in prison. David Earl Luginbull has pleaded guilty to charges he encouraged his girlfriend to turn tricks for his bond. Authorities say they talked about the men she serviced and the money she charged on the jail phone. Conversations are automatically recorded on the jail phone. The Billings Gazette reports he was sentenced to a total of 5 years, with three suspended. I was going to ask if there's anybody out there who doesn't know that jail phone calls are monitored, but I guess that's a rhetorical question. I mean, why would you give such detailed information over a prison phone, never mind the fact that you're comfortable pimping out your girlfriend and she's comfortable doing it? Well, there's one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0201. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0201. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCore in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.